Hello and welcome to another episode of Talking with the Wounded with me, your host, Ben Stevens. In this episode, we're going to tick off a few firsts for this podcast. He's the first cavalryman that we've had, a former Blue and Royal. He's the first sniper that we've had, which is unusual for the cavalry, as you think of them as being in tanks or on horses. He's also the first Conspicuous Gallantry Cross winner that we've had. And it's also, I think, the first incident where their injury was captured on film, and you can go and watch the aftermath of it all on YouTube, if that's what you feel like. So let me introduce you to my guest, Simon Maloney. Simon, hello.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for your time today. Thank you for having me over.
Pleasure. Well, thank you for coming. Simon, let's start with a very brief outline of when you joined, who you joined, what you did.
Yeah, so joined in 2008. I was 17, just 17. So I went to Bazenbourne for junior entry training. So we did 20 weeks phase one with sort of everyone that was 17, really. It was infantry, there was all the corps. I then went to Bovington to do my phase two, which is where you did like your armoured stuff. I'm pretty sure most cavalrymen go straight to the Knightsbridge side of things. I don't know whether I slipped the net.
So you've chosen the Blues and Royals?
Yeah.
So for the listener, you would recognise them from being on horseback at Horse Guards in London and all the big ceremonial events. You see them. We call them donkey wallopers if you're into Foot Guards.
I don't know what
they call us, but... So you chose to join the Blues and Royals because...
I always wanted to join the Household Division. I was always going to join the military. I was always interested in Household Division. I went to the recruiting office in Wembley. I had a very pissed off Irish guard who said, don't join the guards. And he said, join the cavalry instead.
Right, okay. Because most of the other guys have walked in a careers office and seen a grenadier or whoever it is and end up joining that regiment.
Yeah, no,
so he's a mick and he's telling you don't.
Yeah, he was snapped. And I sort of, he said, what about Household Cavalry? He goes, you do a similar job, you just get lifts everywhere in vehicles. And I thought, do you know what? It doesn't sound too bad. And you still get that, you know, still get to do look smart in the kit. But it turns out I never even did that side of things in my whole career. So,
you never went near a horse.
No, never. I'm terrified of horses. I'm probably the worst cavalryman ever. I'm probably the only sniper with hay fever as well. Yeah.
A sniper with hay fever. And afraid of horses. So, yeah, that's the perfect regiment for
you. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's where this Mick Guard knew that it was more
maybe,
entertaining.
Yeah. I bet he's down the pub that night. Like, yeah, lads, listen to this.
So, you join the Blues and Royals and you then become... What's your job in that regiment? What do you do?
Again, I was too tall to fit in a scimitar, which is a primary role.
Okay, that's a tracked reconnaissance vehicle.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Small thing, three people.
Yeah, three-man crew.
Yeah.
Small little reconnaissance vehicle, quiet as far as armoured vehicles go, and it was recce by stealth and snuggling around conventionally 30 kilometres ahead, going around trying to find the vanguard or whatever it would be and popping up, and you got 30 mil cannon to get you out of trouble if you did get into trouble, but the point was not to get seen.
Yes.
So I turned up day one, too tall to fit as a driver. I couldn't go hatch down, and whenever the gun traversed, it hit me in the head. So... I went straight to what we would call support troop. So rather than having a support company, we have a troop within each squadron that would have 51mm mortar, it would have the snipers, it would have the demolitions experts. It was sort of like the support company within a squadron. Yeah. Same principle. I went straight to there simply because I was already too tall. So I was already like the worst cavalryman ever because I couldn't do my initial job.
This Mick Guard really had the last laugh.
He's
too big to be a cavalryman. Let's send him there.
Yeah, yeah.
I find it really odd. I mean, why are the Blues and Royals taking great big guys like yourself when they know you can't fit in a tank?
Well, there's other roles, isn't there? Yeah. But it's... Also, they still followed that Household Division. Like, you know, back in the day when you had to be over 6 foot, for example, like Queen's Company.
Yeah.
I think, don't they still employ that?
Yes, yeah, we do, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think it's similar, but it's totally counterproductive for the actual role within the cavalry, operationally.
You end up being the sniper?
Not until after my first tour.
So your first tour to where, doing what?
First tour, Helmand Province, Afghan. We were in Musakala, so Battle Group Northwest. and we were the recce platoon based on Jackal.
Okay.
So we mounted ourselves on Jackal, went out, Herrick 11, winter tour. Honestly, just hit a lot of IDs and just struggled with the weather. Struggled to navigate through the mud, through the treacherous rain and the terrain. And it was ground holding, right? In a very IED-filled place, as most winter tours, I think, experience.
Right. You're just getting a lot of vehicles and a lot of people getting blown up all the time.
Yeah, 30% casualties in my troop.
30% in your troop. And how many in a troop?
It's about 16 of us.
16 of you. So 5-6 of you.
Life-changing injuries. No one died, but, yeah, lost legs.
It's not good odds, is it?
No.
So that's your first baptism of fire.
Yeah.
And you see enough of the enemy, you do enough that you go, oh yeah, I'd like to do this again, I'm staying in.
I was 18.
Yeah.
You know, the part of your brain that calculates risk, even if you're intelligent, doesn't do that yet. And you sort of, you just lap it up. But what I did think was I didn't really have an effect on the enemy. That's not what I joined for. But I've really felt a little bit bitter from that tour. We'd taken a lot of casualties.
Because slightly sitting ducks.
Yeah, sitting ducks. I was 18. You know, I look back
at Figure 11 target thinking, when do I get to have a go back?
Exactly that. But I did notice the snipers had an effect. And being where I was in the support troop, there was a couple of the guys that were snipers and that they definitely had an effect. And it appealed to me anyway. And the Irish Guard again says, oh yeah, you can be a sniper. No problem. Luckily, I was in an area you could be, but I knew it wasn't common ground within the armoured cavalry.
Yeah.
And that's what I pursued as soon as I got back. So Craig Harrison, you might have heard of him. He got the longest kill.
Yes.
Yeah, Blue and Royal. He was my troop sergeant on that tour. So
okay.
He was a bit of a beast with regards to training and bringing people on, but he definitely guided me down that path and had a firm hand going towards that course.
Right. So you train to be a sniper, which is a tough course. And you get your sniper's badge, and then your next tour is a winter tour?
No, summer tour.
Summer tour, and you are now a sniper pair. You and your observer.
Correct.
And you deploy again with the regiment, with your own?
Well, we're part of the Brigade Reconnaissance Force, so it was us, four rifles, and then sort of attached arms, but it was the Household Cavalry and four rifles that sort of made up the bulk of the fighting men.
Yeah.
And
whereabouts are you?
So we're BRF are based in Camp Bastion.
Yeah.
You know, good food, good showers, gym. And then we predominantly at that stage, so that was 2013, we were just doing HAFs. So helicopter HAFs. Assault forces.
Okay.
On the Chinooks, landing behind the IED belts. Totally different to my first tour, which was ground holding. And as you know, every time you leave the patrol base, you have to go through the IED belt to have any effect on the enemy, which doesn't always work.
Yeah.
Rarely works.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you get caught on the way back out. But with us this tour, every time we left camp, we were having an effect. And sort of cheating, really, because you're not doing the 8 hours inserts or getting up at Sparrow's Fart for 3 days before to get guns in and whatever else. We would land by helicopter, have an immediate effect on guys that were probably causing problems to the patrol bases and ground holding troops. It was a very nice role, very rewarding role, shall I say, for the amount of work you put in.
And as a sniper, you're not doing long insertions, totally cammed up, nobody knows I'm here for days on end waiting for my shot, which is the sort of image that people have of the sniper.
Yeah.
But you're actually more in a overwatch protection role of guys on the ground.
Correct. It's obviously Afghan, conventionally you are doing that, and it makes you think, well, anyone will want to be a sniper, no one enjoys doing it. I've been on exercises like that and you're all swearing at each other and hating your life, but Afghan, it's in, you are as concealed as you can, but everyone knows where you are. We know that with the Middle East in general. And you're building atmospherics up or trying to get some sort of pattern of life in the short time you're there. And like you said, giving overwatch and protection. There is an element of stealth and stalking, but not really. It's marksmanship, it's observation, and it's passing down information that's going to help guys.
It's telling guys what's happening further afield, round the corner.
Yeah, for sure.
Motorbike on the horizon, yada yada, and then presumably being able to take the shot when the opportunity presents itself.
Yeah, we had a real good training package, you know, and we got in a position where we were firing guys in to within, you know, sometimes 10 metres in certain cases, and firing over guys' heads as they were going in. And, you know, it was all trust. You see, it was well coordinated over the radio. But, yeah, we were shooting over guys' head or hitting targets that were maybe in depth or coming in. It was really good, to be honest. Sniping-wise, I'm quite fortunate. I know a lot of guys have been snipers longer than me that maybe haven't got their experiences on operations.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant tour.
So you're, how old are you now? You're 20?
21, yeah.
21, you're enjoying this job.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you're making a difference, and you're taking it to the enemy. And then what happens? One day it doesn't go quite the way you thought.
Yeah, July 4th, 2013. You know, remember I said when on my first tour, you don't compute the risk. You may be starting to have a brain cell now, and you're also, because of the BRF, you're getting some decent intelligence feeds that you might not have got out in a patrol base for your daily patrol. And we really knew this was going to be punchy, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing mentally. It's obviously very good for preparation, but we knew we were going to get into it. But you treat it like any other operation, went in darkness, set up on the roof that I had looked at the maps and thought gave me the best view, the best chance of defending what, you know, and fulfilling my task, which was to overwatch the guys launching into the Calais ahead and giving direct fire support. Yeah. I'm obviously a cordon facing in. We've cleared the ground behind us. As the guys launched forward, they would just got out of sort of section weapons range. So, you know, 600 metres, the SA-80s are just ineffective to help fire at what I was about to get opened up by. And we had a bit of sporadic fire from behind. And this is the first time I thought, I haven't read the picture as well as I should have. And
okay.
Because I'm now becoming an outer cordon rather than looking in. I'm facing backwards in an area we've just cleared, stopping them coming in.
Yeah.
So we tried to pick up who it was. I saw a Dicker 240 metres away, which with a sniper rifle is absolutely nothing. You know, I could see the guys, I could smell the guy's breath. You could see whether he shaved that morning and what colour his eyes were, but I knew he was dicking me. I asked to engage, didn't get it.
Dicking, for the listener, is somebody in plain sight observing your military movements and actions or placing where you are and telling his colleagues, the enemy, where you are and what you're doing, basically. But they very rarely carry a weapon, so it's difficult to ascertain just how bad they are. Anyway, sorry, go on, Simon.
So you like you said, they're usually in the area we were working in, and on this tour, they'd usually be the commander. You know, they even do things like put the radio in a tree, lean against the tree, and it looks like they're leaning in a tree. Actually, they're transmitting and talking. They really know our rules of engagement, arguably better than some of the blokes do, and they apply them robustly.
Yeah,
you know, they, what they can get away with. They know exactly the threshold between getting shot and not. That day, he must have known it. I was really combing him, just a muzzle of a weapon over the floor, over the wall, or anything like that, or, you know, just...
You wanted to take the shot.
I wanted to take the shot. I'm not gonna shoot him illegally, but I am going to apply the rules of engagement robustly.
But you didn't get authorization.
Didn't get it. Fair enough. You crack on. There's other things going on, and, you know, my little corner of that operation is not overly important to the officer commanding on the ground. So, like, you know, it's how it works. So we continued. The sporadic fire ramped up a bit, and I think, like I said, just as the section that I was covering or troop that I was covering were just out of range where they couldn't really support me or the vicinity of where I was, 15 firing points opened up. I know it's 15 from reports afterwards. At the time, it just felt like I was getting swallowed up by the earth, but pretty punchy. It was my pair on the roof that just got erupted up. Start to try and deal with it.
So you become the focus of attention for a bunch of enemy that,
yeah,
unbeknownst to you, are aware of where you are.
Yeah, so I alluded to it earlier. I'd picked this wicked spot that I failed to realise it's called Old School House, which is a very culturally sensitive building to that area. I'd essentially set up on the town hall where the Taliban do all their teachings, and I plotted up on RHQ.
Okay.
You know, and I've took the Taliban flag down, and I'm there with my 338 on the roof. That's essentially what I'd done.
Yeah.
So they, you know, I read they didn't really give a fuck about what we were doing. It was more of a piss take of what I'd done. It was a you know, a tribal thing.
Yeah.
And I'd sort of poke the nest. So we got opened up on. I started to try and deal with it the best I could. I've got a a 5-round magazine and a bolt action rifle, and it's just not doing too much. I've got a wicked optic. I straight away went back to the guy I knew I could hit, and I knew was probably orchestrating it, and went to drill him. I'm now under contact. You know, yeah. One of the rules of engagement, you know, there's imminent threat to life that I believe he has contributed to. I could then do it.
Yeah.
PKM opens up from the other side, really accurate. PKM, so and what, a machine gun 7.62 or 308 that the Taliban use.
Yeah.
Belt-fed weapon. That's opened up on my right. I've turned right to deal with that because that was causing me more problems than he probably was.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, crack.
And you're lying on the ground?
I'm laying on the roof, but the roof has, like, two bowls in it that I'm sort of in between the two bowls.
Okay.
But obviously, I have to expose myself a certain degree to fire.
Yes.
You've just got to do what you can. I couldn't, if I were to get down on the ground, I wouldn't have seen anything. It's surrounded by walls, so it needs to be on the roof, but, you know, it's one of those. Do you curl into a ball? Do you wait by a door until someone's 10 metres away, or do you try and do what you can? I mean, hindsight's a beautiful thing, but this is all happening within the space of a minute. You've got to think quick and take action before it all comes on top. So I've turned to my right, and seconds later, round has gone in front of Ash's face, the guy next to me.
He's your observer.
He was actually, at that time, a machine gunner. He had a Jimpy with him just because of the nature of how exposed we were. Again, I wouldn't have changed the plan even now because it was a good plan itself too. Yeah, it just went to shit. Yeah, fizzed in front of his face, and he's a strong Mancunian accent, and I sort of remember the beginnings of a word that, you know, rhymes with duck and begins with F. And then I got hit, ripped into my throat. I just felt like I couldn't even tell you it was my throat. I felt like I'd been punched by Mike Tyson or a train or something.
But this isn't hit any other part of your body?
No, it's gone straight through the throat. I wasn't sure at the time what had happened. I just felt this massive kinetic energy pass through, like being struck by lightning, I imagine. Natural reaction was just to roll because I'm trying to gather my senses and it's all, you know, the dust is pinging up. It was accurate, very accurate. How I only took one round is beyond me. Pretty sure my Daysack and other bits of kit have that to explain, all that to thank. Rolled off the roof. And I'm now bracing for quite a big fall. I knew it was probably about 8, 9, maybe 10 feet.
Yeah.
I've rolled off horizontal, lands on my feet. So I was like, how have I done that? Turn around, there's a goat behind me, broken back, legs sprawled out, absolutely screaming in agony, which, to be honest, is the most traumatic part of that day, just hearing that goat screaming. Really pierces through me now.
Because you've landed on the goat.
Landed on the goat, it's knocked me to my feet. I'm like, I've landed on my feet here. I'm shrugging myself off, and this poor goat is looking for a bit of grass and has had, like, you know, 120 kilos pass through him. You know, fronted with a body armour plate, but I've landed on my feet. Yeah. I've then gone to grab my neck.
Your partner's still on the roof?
He's on the roof. He's looking at me. I'm looking at him because I'm trying to look at his face, like, because he can see what I can't.
You're trying to gauge what's wrong with me.
Yeah, and I'm going so I can breathe. The blood isn't jetting up the wall. It's coming, but it's not like something. It's maybe not arterial. I can still breathe. I don't feel faint. So I look at Ash. Ash, how bad is it? And, you know, strong Mancunian accent. He's like, mate! And I'm like, that's all he said for about 3 seconds. I'm like, you need more than that. And he's like, that's right through your fucking neck. So that's shit. And, you know, then a bit of grenade sort of fire went off. We're both looking. I've had to have a quick look out the door. And before I've, in that time, sent over the PRR. I had comms, but I didn't get to send an initial contact report. I'm still trying to gather myself. So I had comms that just said I've been hit in the throat. I've been hit in the throat, just on the PRR. It's the personal world radio, you know, 400 metres in good?
Good.
The guys could get it.
Yeah.
Again, but at that stage, I've got up back on the roof. My radio is in my day sack. People will say bad drills, good drills, whatever. I rolled away from my day sack, unfortunately. So I've grabbed the radio.
You've gone back up onto the roof?
To get the radio. To report up and send a full contact report. Because initially, all right, there was guys coming up through the door, not through the door, but within 10 metres, ready to come in, as in Taliban.
Yeah.
Ash and I have dealt with them, or at least made them think about coming through the door. We've got incoming grenades, you know, it was all going off.
You're thinking, we need the cavalry.
We need the cavalry, literally. Also, let's have it right. I was convinced I was going to die, and I thought I need to go out with a bang. I'm not going to be on the radio giving a contact report. I'm going to have a good scrap, and if I keel over, I keel over. I'm not gonna, you know, be laying here when people find me, you know, in a ball, wishing I've got to give it some ego completely, but you know, it repelled them for a second.
That's the fight or flight.
Yeah, for sure.
Kicks in. So you get in survival mode. You get your contact report out, and you start dealing with the enemy that's closing in on you.
Yeah. Little do I know, Wes Masters has heard me on the PRR. So this is when I've just got injured. And he's dashed 400 metres through the Taliban that are firing at me. Because it was, you know, I wasn't quite 360, but it was all sides. Full kit, open, down straight down the road, completely open and exposed.
You only get away with that sort of thing once.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's a good job he didn't leave his med pack back there.
Yeah.
And he's come through. We knew each other quite well. We're good friends. And he looks at my throat and I'm saying, I'm showing him and I'm looking at the... We've all probably experienced it where you have a quiet word, a casualty, or even if it was an Afghan and you go, he's not going to make it, or, you know, it's not good.
Yeah, yeah.
I was looking at his poker face thinking, I was waiting for one look where he goes, yeah, size done, and he didn't. And I thought, he's either got a really good poker face or I can be... Yeah. He's either got a really good poker face or I should be all right. I should be fine.
I'm going to make it.
Yeah. He patched me up. And like I said, you know, your mate looks you in the eye and says you're going to make it. I take that as gospel. You know, we had a good enough relationship. Yeah, Wes says you're going to make it. I started to think maybe it's not too bad. Also out of my mind, the guy that shot me was the guy I wanted to engage before, no doubt, because it was the only isolated compound from the direction in which the round had come in. And I knew pretty well where it had come in because it went through me. You know, you can hear it. You sort of look through the hole in your throat and it's through there. But section commander's come back. We've got a group of it. Now, you know, 16 at least of us, you know, big multiple pouring, you know, putting up in positions and getting a grip of that compound, controlling the compound, winning the firefight.
Yeah.
It gives me the chance to have a crack at the guy.
So you've been patched up at this stage?
Yeah, I've got a...
Like a first field dressing?
Yeah, a makeshift first field dressing. He couldn't first field dress in my throat because I wouldn't have been able to breathe. So he cut bits up with his trusty scissors and sort of a bit of tape and a bit of this and sort of made this
But you're bandage. Still breathing through your mouth?
Yeah.
So...
He come towards me with a Cripe kit and I said, I will bite you and fight you until I pass out. You are not coming nowhere near me with that. He was going to crike me. I think he just wanted to try it. Like, I know what Wes is like.
Well, to tracheotomy.
Yeah, I said you can get fucked.
Yeah.
Not a chance.
You're not having that. Because you can breathe all right.
I'm breathing okay.
So this is what...
I sounded deep. I sound like Phil Mitchell after a bender.
So this is removed your Adam's apple.
The round has gone through. It's gone through the gap between my windpipe and my main artery, and I have a hole there and a hole there, so either side of my Adam's apple.
Okay.
The kinetic energy of the round hitting my throat has pushed everything important outwards, and it's gone through soft tissue. It's also a tracer round,
so it's
cauterized on the way through.
Okay.
When I eventually got to Bastion Hospital, the surgeon said he couldn't have made that incision on the operating table without killing me. He goes...
Because the gap isn't... It's only the force of the kinetic energy has pushed it to make the hole for the round to pass through.
The fact that I was walking wounded, no one... You know, I didn't believe I'd been shot straight through. I thought I'd have shrapnel either side. Because you just thought he'd rip everything out. And I'm in a thigh position when he's done this. So my neck's scrunched up a bit. Or, you know, I'm not exactly holding it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The head's the last thing you're...
It's something... It's not worth thinking about, if you know, of how it happened.
Close. Yes.
But the only reason they eventually got to, it was a through and through, is they did the MRI scan where they put the dye in and you could see the hole. And if held open, you could have slowly, you know, pushed a pencil through.
Yeah.
But
okay, so he's patched you up as best he can there and then, and that's what's all over YouTube or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you've still got the fight.
Yeah. But like I said, I'm good to go. I'm pumped full of adrenaline. Probably more awake than I would be normally at that time in the morning. It's about 6:30, you know, usually I'm still moaning and trying to sip my coffee when I can. No, but we're in it. I've had a chance you're buzzing and you're in a pretty good firefight, and actually the fear is over. It was pretty, you know, squeaky bum time, and there was two of us plus the camera team. We're now there full multiple. We've got guns on the roof. We had OCs like, you need indirect fire, you've got it.
You're thinking,
the Apaches are coming in. This is what we joined for. You know, you've had a close scrape, but did remember thinking, you know, we need to get this guy. So the section commander he got an MID that day. Wes got a military cross that day. Sedge said, yeah, you can go. And I was waiting for his sort of, you know, rapid fire. And I was going to pop out the doorway and have a go at this guy. The guy didn't come out. So Sedge just ran up and down the roof. He goes, you definitely got him. I said, I've got him, Sedge. You know, and Sedge just ran up and down the roof to draw the fire.
What, the old tethered goat
scenario? Yeah. Normally, we always, you know, joke, isn't it? It's the guy that no one likes that gets told to do it. But section commander took it on the chin and did it himself. So although he got an MID that day, he got a massive bollocking that day as well. Just like, don't ever fucking do that again, you lunatic.
You're the leader. Can you not? Yeah.
You know, pop your head above.
That's what the junior bod's for, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so he draws the enemy fire, and that, I mean, it results in you being able to take this person.
Yeah, I engaged him. Got a good hit, good central hit. I'm confident he died. Didn't hear it on ICOM because we had other things on, but I'm confident he's gone.
Yeah.
I put another one into him just through pure anger, bad discipline, and then took a second round to the helmet. So
you then get another round hits you in the helmet.
It moved the helmet.
Yeah.
I've got marks on the helmet. Yeah. It wasn't a direct hit.
Yeah.
But I had a middle parting for sure.
So you're... Okay, so you're now thinking, all right, maybe I'm not bulletproof.
Yeah, my neck was wound in then. I think the adrenaline has finally burnt off. And you then go, yeah, like, you know, wind your neck in. What do we need to do? And I was quite happy then to sort of... I'll admit it. I was quite happy to sort of look at the section commander and follow his commands rather than, you know, running around. But we did have a job to do. You know, I was the only sniper there. You know, and, you know, carried on engaging. But the reason I could do that was because the team around me was so good. The boss was unflappable. The section commander was all over it. Medic had made me feel completely calm.
Everybody stepped up.
Everyone stepped up. It was my time of need. I was completely in their hands. Everyone stepped up. And in that respect, I'm very lucky.
So this continues on until, at what moment have you managed to break contact or enemy have?
90 minutes in, the Merc can't land. It's a Chinook, too big and cumbersome for where we were going to land. Pedro have now been called. Pedro, the PJs, American PJs, who are actually special forces, like the pararescue jumpers, the branch of the Air Force that are sort of SF recovery guys. You know, their forte is parachuting onto stricken boats in the middle of the sea and rescuing everyone. And real tough selection. And
right, okay.
So they've landed.
Yeah.
But they've had to lie to land. They've said that to their boss that I am now
critical.
I'm on the stretcher. I'm gone if they don't land. He says, right, go and get him. Their intentions were to drop two PJs off, come and just stabilize me.
Yeah.
And then the Black Hawk would stay and he would come and get me whenever.
And then they discover that you're actually wandering around.
Well, they
still in the firefight.
They landed. We secured the HLS for them, as you do. They landed. They ran off to speak to the medic for a handover. I sprinted past both of them because, again, it was, you know, you're still incoming. Jumped on the Black Hawk and Wes went, he's behind you. They turned around and went, sweet, and ran on the Black Hawk. And then they're all over me. They said, we didn't realise you were running. It's the pilot that said he's just jumped on.
Yeah,
I wasn't hanging around.
No.
You know, and I said, what do you mean, guys? What, you know, I never met these guys. What were you going to do? And they said, we were just going to land and fight with you guys. And I was thinking, you were going to drop yourself into that very precarious situation. And also, you don't know the unit. They might, you know, imagine land and it's a bunch of monks, and you think, oh, what have we jumped into here? You know, fair play to them, hats off. It's some job they do.
Yeah. So, you get extracted out. The rest of your team are left on the ground.
Yeah.
You get extracted back to Bastion.
Yeah, Bastion, correct. Taken into the hospital, again, first class, just absolutely world leading, isn't it?
Yeah.
Got every sort of specialist of every department there, all stood there with their notepads, having a look, looking at your vitals, reading all the reports, and they sort of argue about who's going to do what. Feel like a piece of meat, literally, you know, like cardiothoracic, I'm doing this, no, I need to do this, and eventually decide. They also didn't know what was going on, really, because you've got two holds, you've got an entry and an exit, but you still can't quite believe that it's passed through, because there would have been more injuries, yeah?
And you can talk.
I'm walking, talking. So this is what I mean. It sounds atrocious.
So they're wondering, talking. Whoa, how much invasive surgery they need to do.
Yeah, and is he going to keel over and die at any point?
Because we don't know if...
He's giving it beans now, but he might... You know, there might be some stuff going on.
So MRI scan, or let's get a picture of it.
Yeah, somehow. MRI scan, and then straight into theatre. And essentially what they were going to do is open me up, because it did go through my thyroid gland, which, you know,
yeah,
later in life might cause problems, or could cause problems at any point, really.
You'd be all right. I've had one of mine removed.
Fine.
You can survive.
Yeah, fine. But they were going to open it up, have a look, and then, if needs be, open it up more and more and more, and, you know, just... Peel the layers back, so to speak.
Yeah, and get it stable. So they do all of this in Bastion?
Yes, correct.
So you're not waking up in Birmingham?
No, I woke up actually that day to the lads I was on ops with.
Damn, I'm still here.
Yeah. Well,
actually probably woke up pleased.
Woke up weird. First time I'd actually been under anaesthetic. Woke up to a cleavage in my face, and thinking I was in heaven. I actually said, am I in heaven? And these two nurses were like, yeah, heard that one before. But, you know, I've got these two beautiful American nurses that I've... Because I did not know where I was. And then it takes you a lot of time to gather what happened, especially a not traumatic, but a busy day like that.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot to compute.
And then you're looking around and it's slowly coming back to you. And then the guys are on the end of your bed as well, who are you on ops with, which I'm very lucky. I know... Obviously, guys at Triple Amputees.
Your guys are all based in Bastion, so they can come and...
They came off there. The op, yeah. Handed the kit in. The CQ had a rover waiting to take them up to the hospital to do the right thing, yeah. Which is, again, fantastic. How many guys, you know, Triple Amputees wake up in Birmingham, don't see the blokes for 6 months?
Well, the previous guests, they wake up and first thing they see is their mum next to their bed, and they're sort of going, whoa, what are you doing out here?
I can't imagine.
They can't work it out. So you wake up, a bunch of mates around you. Presumably, it doesn't take long for the piss-taking to start.
No. Counter-sniped, that's just me now. Worst sniper ever, getting counter-sniped.
Yeah.
I still bite now. I've got a tube coming from my neck, so the lads are puffing the tube, trying to see if my cheeks blow up like a hamster.
Really helpful stuff.
Yeah, also, I'd argue 97% of them didn't give a fuck about me. They were just there for the nurses. A lot of visitors with their backs to me, if that makes sense, trying to talk to so-and-so American nurse with makeup on and perfume. And
You're doing them a great injustice. They were there for you.
They weren't there for me. I was their ticket.
You were their ticket to possible crack at the nurses.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean...
I'll take that.
Would you have done any different?
No, 100% not. I don't expect any less.
Exactly. But they're there, and you worked out then, as you're lying there with the tube out, that you're going to be okay.
I was confident, yeah. I was confident. I was confident at the time, to be honest. But I still hadn't computed exactly what had happened. It's only after the surgery the nurse said, listen, you'd had a through-on-through diagrams, this, that, and the other. And I even said, how? And I said to the surgeon, how's that happened? And he even said, I don't know. He did give me good advice. He said, in my opinion, it's not good to dwell on these things. He was like, you're still here. Let's draw a line under it. And I think that was sound advice.
In terms of thinking about, oh, if it had just been another millimetre that way, I wouldn't... You can procrastinate over that forever.
Yeah. Well, I was 3 months into the tour, confident, because we were about to go on R&R. I was confident I was going to come back. You know, you've got 3 months' worth of fighting to do. I need to stamp these thoughts out.
Yeah. So, how long are you in hospital for?
5 days. Flew back home.
On to R&R, or is this a wounded sort of compassionate...
I got flown home. I got 3 weeks R&R. So, okay. I've, again, bluffed an extra week's leave.
Okay.
The boys come back sort of a week later, maybe 4 or 5 days later by that stage.
Yeah.
And the fight was to get my stitches out in time. That was the only thing that would stop me redeploying because of infection.
Yeah. Okay.
Stitches came out. I went for a quick...
Back in Bastion or while you're back at R&R?
Back in the UK.
Right.
I had a quick psych evaluation. Why do you want to go back? You must be angry. No.
Because the system is thinking you're coming home and you're not going back.
Yeah, for sure. The OC did. He said to me, you don't have to come home. I said, I want to come back. I need to be back with the lads. I can't be staying at home. I'm, as you can see, I'm fighting fit.
Sitting back at the rear party, going...
Yeah, they're not. I'm not going to get it off. I'm going to be on guard, listening to blokes' contact stories 10th down the line, but when it's got back over Facebook or whatever it is. And yeah. I'm good to go. You just feel like a sellout. And you want to be back with the lads. This, I think my mental health would have gone only downhill if I'd stayed at home, for sure.
And then getting back in the tribe, very important.
Yeah.
So,
back on
you get the stitches out and back you go.
Yeah, quick psych evaluation. You know, check I'm not going to be some like bloodthirsty lunatic as soon as I get out there. And
Rambo hasn't.
Yeah. Hold the nearest Afghan hostage as soon as I land. And back into it. I was into it a little bit too quickly. I think I landed. BRF had a job on the next morning and they said they need an extra sniper. Do I want to do it? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. And then walked away going, fucking hell. Like, last time I was in the shit, I was bleeding and I'm going to be on a rooftop tomorrow morning. As we were going in as well, that particular job, the landing got waved off twice because we landed in a sort of, they basically had identified where the HLSs are going to be in this area. And there was, you know, three fire positions waiting as we came off. So it got waved off twice. The Chinooks told us to, AH told us to go.
Yeah.
And eventually we flew back. And I remember thinking then I had a close shave then, but I remember I was very different that day on the way in. You know, I was sweating buckets.
Well, because now you know what can happen.
Yeah, you do. You feel vulnerable.
And the bit you alluded to earlier about the risk assessment ability of a 21-year-old, yours has now been wrapped up a few levels.
Yeah, you've connected the dots. Yeah. The circuit's complete.
You're fully aware of what... Yeah. Okay. But you remain for the rest of that tour.
Yeah.
When you look back on that tour, you have worse days, you have badder days, or was that as gnarly as it got?
That was one of the best days of my life, getting shot. Because I'm very...
That's not a sentence you hear.
Yeah, for sure. But I say that because of, you know, previous guests or guys you hear that get injured. So much came from that day. You know, I was with my mates that day. We got to enjoy it. And so I know it was the best day because I know how fortunate I am compared to guys that have got injured, woken up in Birmingham, lost limbs, life changed forever. I walked away from it. Got a pretty cool story and let's have it right, a bit of glory, bragging rights. And I know I'm very aware that's not the case for a lot of guys. Definitely had worse days that tour. We took a casualty on the last stop. One of my good friends, Jay, was killed, which I was sort of involved with. Yeah, definitely worse days. That day for me was no trauma from it at all, if I'm totally honest.
Yeah. You get to the end of the tour. You've had this experience. You've just alluded to it. You've lost a mate right near the end, which is a tough one to take for everybody. And you return to the UK and all is well with you in terms of what you're thinking about doing, remaining in the military, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Slightly bitter. Like I said, I got injured. I managed to go out and settle the score, so to speak, even the score out. Last op, your mate gets killed. One of them ops, things just... We just got caught out with bad ambush. No one's fault, yeah, but, you know, something really bad happened and you come back in and you're supposed to have this elation where you're handing your rifle in and you're thinking about going back to women and booze and spending your money that you've planned so hard for. And I didn't want to go back because we wanted at least one more op to go and stick it to him. Instead, you're handing your weapon in and you're supposed to be looking forward to going home. And you actually instantly feel guilty because your mate is going home, but, you know, he's in a coffin.
You're not getting a chance to settle the score.
No, you're not getting a chance to settle the score. And that climax is now an absolute stinker, to be honest. No one wanted to go home. We all wanted a fight. It's left a bitter taste in our mouths.
You've just fallen off a cliff face.
Yeah, it's gone. It's turned.
And it's all flat. You come home and everyone is elated to see you. Friends, family, girlfriends, yeah. Partners, whatever. Everyone's delighted to be seeing you and you're all sitting there going, we don't want to be here.
No. You're angry. You're bitter. It's venomous. You're not processing it. You've got the funeral to deal with. So you're actually quite sad. But you know, what do? You're probably soldiers. I know I definitely did try and turn that into anger, which was fine in Afghan. You had an outlet for it, but you don't have that now. And the army has to go on. you still eventually come back off leave. You have
got a job to do.
Jobs to do. You have exercises to go on, and you've not moved on.
But you're still in the tribe, though. So you're amongst kindred spirits.
Yeah, for sure.
You're still in your close-knit team, but you're beginning to rage against the machine, are you, at this stage? Or are you just going, hey, okay, we're over it now, we're back to the day job?
I think you put it in a box, or I put it in a box, and I cracked on with the day job. I did still like my day job. You know, that box eventually will come back up, but I didn't see that at the time. I was definitely functioning fine. I was a soldier, and I was enjoying being a soldier, and let's have it right. You're the guys in camp that have just come back of a tour where you've been getting stuck in. You walk around like a dog with two dicks. You flavour for a bit. You get the course. People look at you a little bit differently.
Yeah.
But as we all know, that soon fades.
At what stage do you find out about your award?
So I was on Junior Brecon.
So this is how long? 6 months after the tour?
6 months, yeah. I think this was in March.
Okay. Did you know that somebody had written up for you for this?
I hadn't even thought about it, and I didn't want to think about it.
And Wes and everybody else, all the rest of the team who got awards, nobody knows anything.
No one knew anything. Looking back now, I had a few questions asked of me from the colonel at the time, who was CO ISTAR.
Who wanted to get his facts straight.
Yeah, he came in at my bedside, and I'm still a bit hazy from the anaesthetic, and he asked a few questions like, you know, how was it? Well done. And then he sort of said, you know, what happened when you got shot? And I talked him through it, and he sort of said, oh, so you reoccupied the position, you got back up on the roof. And I just said, yeah. I said, I'd monged it, left my radio, I had to. And, you know, he goes, and you were engaging. And he sort of got the facts straight before, I think, looking back now, I understand what he was doing.
Okay.
At the time, I didn't have a clue, to be honest. I was, you know...
Coming around from anaesthetic.
Yeah, exactly. Could have said anything. I didn't have a clue. Yeah, I could have
talked your game up or ruined your chances.
Yeah, I've either done myself a big favour or I've absolutely ruined it. And when Junior Brecon, instructor hated me. I was the only guy there with a blue beret.
Okay, because everyone else is...
Yeah, everyone's infantry.
Infantry.
I had to do that course.
I was going to say, what were you, cavalryman, what are you doing? Okay.
To do sniper commanders, you needed Junior Brecon.
Right.
Not a bad course to do anyway, but I needed to do that in order to go on to sniper commanders. You know, he didn't want me there. I felt like saying, mate, I don't want to fucking be here either. But here we are. Anyway, I got called out of the class. OC is like, your colonel's on the phone. And I've been a bit of a knobhead, I think, the weekend before downtown. Not fighting, but scuffling, being a bit of a dick. And I was thinking, something's bit me in the arse there.
Thought you were getting a bollocking?
Or, as, I don't know, if you, like, in Afghan, you're always going over to the American PX and taking all sorts for the gym from the American PX. You know, I wasn't on steroids or anything, but... These like Lightning Jack 3D and all them things that are now would get you kicked out of the army, right? You could buy from the American PX, you'd fail the CDT, to my knowledge.
Oh, right, these are all sort of muscle.
Yeah, you're smashing it in the gym. And normally I wouldn't be worried, but the colonel's on the phone for a fucking reason. It's not to ask how my weekend was. So I thought, scrapping downtown or I failed a CDT on, you know.
A CDT?
Compulsory drugs test.
Okay.
I thought something's come back. From that, some sort of anomaly or whatever. I'm thinking all sorts. It's not good, is it?
Yeah.
So he's, and he's playing along with it, the OC. He's at Brecon. He's sort of going, Colonel's on the phone. He's like, any idea what this is about? And he can tell I'm sweating. And I think he's like, I'm not going to tell him. Get told, oh, I'm having honours and awards list has come out. You've been awarded a conspicuous gallantry cross. From the tone of his voice, I know I've been let off the hook. I'm not aware of what a conspicuous gallantry cross was. I didn't know if it was a... I didn't know what it was on the pecking order.
You
know?
Where is it on the pecking order?
It's number 2. I didn't know that. I had to Google it afterwards. But it's so, one below the VC.
One below the VC, okay. Yeah.
Also,
so there's not many of them around.
No, there's not. It only came out in 1993 as well, so there's only 53 or 54 been given out.
Okay.
Simply because of how long it's been around. It's not been around that long. OC's like, knew, could tell by the look of my face. He Googled it, spun the monitor around and showed me it. And he said, well done. I didn't have a clue what it was for, though. I thought it was maybe for the day with Jay.
Right.
Not saying I did multiple events where they were medal-winning events. I'm not saying that. Medal-winning action, sorry.
Yeah.
But for me, that was the most traumatic and toughest day. I thought maybe that's the day I've dug out the most. So then you feel guilty straight away. I don't want a medal for that day. Fucking Jay's died. Yeah. It was a struggle. The Kazovac was a struggle. I just felt shit about that day. Still hadn't, it's only 6 months on, I haven't nearly had the conversation I needed to have with people that day, or his dad, or anyone that have made me feel sort of at a point where I can talk about it now without bursting into tears, if I'm honest. So I'm not sure. Yeah, anyway, yeah. The Sergeant Major at Brecon, when I've turned up, called me a course dealing donkey walloping cunt, said, I'll give you a couple of weeks before you're off the course. I get pulled off the course to go into London to do all this media stuff. So I'm essentially going on the piss in London, right?
Okay.
OC's cleared it. He says, I'll miss this week, which is lessons, but I'll catch up in the field next week. So I'm still on the course. He goes, just tip your hat to the Sergeant Major. So I'm like, fuck, here we go. Knock on the door. Just to let you know, I'm off down to London this week. I'll catch up next week. Did it purposely to piss him off. He went, because he thought I'd jacked. He's throwing his pay stick at me. I've dodged it. And like the OC's been like, oh, Corporal Maloney's just been ordered a conspicuous gallantry cross. He'll be away this week, but I've cleared it with his instructor. He's going to catch up next week. It's like a little wink to the Sergeant Major as I left. And I shouldn't have done that because I was 2 weeks in and I had 8 weeks on tactics.
You marked your card.
Yeah.
It's not every day you get one of those things.
You got to take the shot, haven't you? It was a cheap shot, but you got to take it. So I've gone into London.
So that's what you did. You're on London, you're on, I don't know, what are you on? Good morning breakfast?
All sorts. Yeah. You know, the media have spun it, brothers in arms, because of Wes as well. Wes has been ordered a military cross, and he saved my bacon, which he did.
Yeah.
And they're giving it, and we were really enjoying ourselves, to be honest. You're in London, people are pulling all the stops out for you, dinners, and
it was
definitely a weird experience. But again, you're not saying no to the beer, but you're deeply filled with guilt. Guys didn't come home. Guys have lost legs and are not getting the day out in London. You know, guys are really struggling, and I was fully aware of that.
Yeah. So the guilt creeps back, and you return to Brecon.
Went to Brecon, finished the course.
Not Major hounding you every inch of the way.
Yeah, we won't be. We don't send each other Christmas cards.
I don't think anybody sends the Sergeant Major Christmas cards, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. The course was fine, carried on.
You carried on soldiering for how long?
That was 2014, at the beginning of 2014. I stayed in the army to 2017, so went on to do the regimental stuff, the Canadas, the Kenyas. I did a bit of Nordic skiing in Norway, okay. And I've tried to then, I did a lot of sniping competitions.
Did you get promoted?
Yeah, I've got to full screw after Brecon.
Full screw?
Sorry, it's a Lance Corporal Horse in the cavalry. Let's not get into that, it's a whole podcast in itself.
Lance Corporal Horse, which is like a Lance Sergeant which is like a corporal in everywhere else outside the household division.
Yeah.
And there's no more tours, there's no more operations.
No, there was, you probably knew you weren't going to go back to Afghan, but you thought you might. Then there was like the odd Syria or like XTT to Iraq and stuff like that.
Okay.
But we got too used to being Brigade Reconnaissance Force, and we're now back to Armoured Reconnaissance, and they are not getting deployed.
Right.
So we're also picking this new vehicle up, Ajax, which is, no one still doesn't know what they're doing now. And I left 5 years ago.
Yeah. It's picked up, but not.
Yeah, the regiment hasn't done a lot considering the tempo they were used to. I mean, the Household Cavalry were the most deployed unit for Afghan because they jump between 16-hour assault, then you could jump onto the next tour with the BRF, then you could
do the formation reconnaissance
stuff. There was all, you could bounce around the squadrons and get on. It's not uncommon for blokes to have done six Afghans.
Yeah. Okay, so why did you leave in 2017?
Alluded to it earlier. 17, you join the army, you get thrashed, you bounce back, you just don't compute it. 18, you don't compute the risk. 21, you're starting to. 27 when I left, you are answering back. I was starting to. I was still very angry about how Afghan had finished.
So you haven't had any treatment at this stage. You're in and everyone thinks you're fine, mm-hmm. and you've got your gong and...
Yeah.
Deep down inside, do you know you're not right, or...?
No, not at the time. I'm still just feeling the heat. But I did have I went to a training regiment, so I'm training phase one recruits, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
I had a very young officer stop me mid-lesson of reaction to effective enemy fire, tell me that's not what you do. No, not slating cap badges. He was Army Air Corps. I felt very strongly, having been in contact, and that I did. And that was the first time I checked myself... It didn't end well for either of us. He always wins, obviously. He's the boss, and I was the godly fool screw. But I checked myself for the first time then, and went, I still think I'm right now, but you're being a bit of a dick. And I didn't want to be that guy that was the crusty Vietnam War vet who's, you know, sat there with his bandana drinking rum saying you weren't there. I sort of checked myself and thought, fucking hell, Si, you need to drop this now or accept your fate. And I thought, yeah, I'm getting out. You got to move on.
Time was done.
Yeah, time was done. We weren't doing anything. I'm proud of what I did. I'm very proud of the army now, but I was at danger of being a bitter, twisted old man at 27, you know?
Yeah. So you leave. Have you been diagnosed?
No.
With PTSD, do you think there's a bit of that going on? Have you sought a bit of treatment?
I'm working it out, basically. You're so busy in the army and you live in the block, you can get away with drinking hard, fighting, smashing fizz, just hitting things at 100 miles an hour, because the army life, that's what you are required to do. And you jump on the treadmill, so to speak, and it's absolutely awesome.
Let's go, go, go.
It is, it's awesome. And then I left with that same thing, and you sort of took you're in the midst of it, and it sort of takes you a while to look around and go, not everyone's like that. Then you start to take your foot off the gas, and that for me was when the wheels fell off. I realised I probably hadn't taught myself how to relax and chill out. Chilling out was going out on a bender with the boys, to be healthy, you go to the gym at 100 miles an hour, and that pendulum swings deeper each time, I find. And sort of the analogy I've managed to sort of come to, you know, it goes from, you know, being really healthy to then hitting it hard to then this, and the pendulum keeps swinging. What you need to do is actually take the swing out of the pendulum or find somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
But that's a journey you needed to do. I got to a point where I was at work once, flew off the handle about something that totally didn't warrant me flying off the handle.
Work is what?
Broadcast industry. So I go to football stadiums, rig the stadiums, anything that's filmed outdoors, so stadiums, venues, music events.
Put it crudely, but you're lugging a lot of cabling around?
Yeah, we're pulling cable. We pull cable and drive trucks.
Okay.
We pull cable.
And is this your business, or this is a business with mates?
I subcontract to the big broadcast companies.
Okay.
I sell myself as a rigger. I also started my own business hiring out that cable that we used, which is proving to be the avenue I want to follow, because it's less work and a bit more money. Especially having a little boy, it's the baby changes things. You don't want to be away on the road all the time, you know?
Yeah. So you're doing that job. You've flown off the handle at a few people. I'm getting you haven't checked yourself in with anybody that might deal with this, or
no.
Maybe you're just comfortable going, I know what it is, I know how it is, and I know what little box to keep it in. And
yeah, I kept doing that, and you put the tiny plaster on the leak, you know, the Band-Aid, and it's fine, and that's a temporary release of relaxing of the pressure. Then the flew off the handle, burst into tears. Things weren't going right. I'd had a couple of friends who had openly spoken about PTSD and had been diagnosed for it and gone for it, say, Si, you know, you have got a few problems, mate, and these are things that are not. But I always thought, I haven't been through nearly enough of what this guy's gone through, or that. And you compare yourself. But eventually I thought enough was enough. I was run a charity called PTSD Resolution. Yeah. Absolutely fantastic. I tried initially to go to the doctors about 6 months prior, really built it up to go and do it. And the doctor made me fill out a survey, gave me a score. I came back 2 weeks later, we did it again. The score was less. He said, see, you're getting better. And I could have killed him, which would have been a real ironic thing for someone that's gone in there to say they're a bit angry. So that put me off treatment altogether. And then eventually, you know, the waterworks have come out. I'm sat in my car at work, absolute shit state. First time I thought, not about going to end my life, but I thought, I understand why people end their lives. Just to get a fucking break from this relentless. You keep trying to better yourself and you're just not getting away from it. You know, it was just relentless. PTSD Resolution.
That's a charity. And how did you find them? Is that what your mates had done?
Yeah, a mate of mine had said, mate, give these a go. And he is the most anti-help man ever. He's the real grumpy git.
So you thought, well, if he's doing it,
If he can talk to him, I can definitely do it. I'm not big, you know, I'm big enough to recognise that. Rung them. I mean, I sobbed my heart out, and this poor woman went, really sorry, I'm just the...
just the receptionist.
I'm the receptionist, I said, oh, you don't have ever signed up to this. She said, no, I've got your details. Someone will call you. I thought, oh, here we fucking go. Call me back within half an hour. I said,
I've unloaded all the receptionists. Yeah, I'm all right now.
I'm all right now. I had a lady called Claire who was local to my area. She was absolutely fantastic. Built a rapport straight away on the phone. Managed to coach me towards having a session with her. You can do it face to face, or you can do it over Zoom. I said I'd like to do face to face first, I need to make my mind up and build the trust before we have a chat or I open up. She was fantastic. She quickly identified for me. A lot of us don't need cuddling. We need to understand what's going on. We're not guys that you need to cuddle. Just to teach her to fish, and we'll fish ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
She quickly identified he needs to know what's going on in his head. She sort of explained how it works in your brain, in the nervous system, where you're at and why you suppress this. And that sort of got my mind engaging then. And it was honestly, at one point, one thing she said, just the switch went like that. I know everyone's journey is different, but for me,
you got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant.
And no medication involved?
No.
So you're not...
I wasn't that bad. I know, I understand, I was against medication, but I understand why people have to be medicated, because sometimes you need to have that reset, you really do. I really get it.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough where she could get in through other ways.
And she's given you the tools that you know how to manage it and deal with it, and would you say you are... recovered? Is that the right term?
No, I'd say I'm managing it.
Managing it.
I would say I'm managing it. I don't think you ever recover. I think it will come back all the time.
Yeah. You can burst into tears in the car any time, but you can manage now understand why that is.
You understand the signs, you know what to do, you have a drill, you're not just walking into the killing field like sheep, so to speak. You've got your drills, you know what to do. It's similar to what we got taught in the military.
Yeah. And then you get on the emotional roller coaster of then working partner and small baby appears.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which focuses the mind, and that's where you are today, right?
Correct. I mean, he's 5 weeks old, but having a kid or having a child is the first time I've had purpose since Afghan, It's for me. It's something to put my energy into, something I've had purpose. He relies on me. I have to...
It's the reason why you have to get up in the morning.
Yeah, for sure. And before, you didn't give a fuck whether you were fed, shaved. You don't care about yourself. And that's what the soldiers, that's what you're taught in the British Army. But when you've got a bloke relying for you, you'll get up every time. And, as we all have experienced, that's what happens.
Yeah. So you've got real purpose, and there's a reason now to forge ahead with making the best of what you can with your life. There's just one interesting thing that when I was doing my research about you, you sold your medals. Why did you do that?
I never turned the medal down. Like I've said before, there was a lot of guilt attached to the medal. But, the medal does reflect, it's just such a Chad comment, but people have said this to me, the medal reflects the unit. It's good that the unit got a CGC. I think 2 or 3 MCs from that tour, et cetera, et cetera. Brilliant for the unit, it's recognition. Reality is, everyone else that day should have got the medal. I was the one that got scooped out of the shit and saved. That's my opinion. Was I going to turn it down? No. Did it do my career favours? Yes. I got the courses I wanted to go on. I got the post into Winchester that I wanted because you were the poster boy or the CGC winner, and it's good for the regiment and recruitment and all that things. However, I never walked around. I haven't worn that medal since I left the army. I go to Remembrance Day parade just in I dress up, I don't wear the medals. Not the sort of thing I want to do or remember. And let's have it right, I'm from a council estate. My parents still live on a council estate. I sold the medal for 130 grand. That is a life-changing amount of money. And it started my business. I now live...
There was a financial reason for wanting to do it. It wasn't just... I don't want this anymore.
It wasn't pure hate, but there was I had no remorse selling it. I didn't go, it wasn't a hard choice.
So this is physically selling your medal with your name on it and regimental number that some collector now has.
Yeah.
And you've still got the miniature. People still know that you have it.
Well, if I ever wanted to big time it, I just wear a replica. I used to wear a replica on my my number two dress in the army.
Anyway, because the original is too valuable.
And I hate to say it now, but, you know, what do? People have podcasts and YouTube channels and all these other things to tell stories. It's not like I'm going to sit there around the fire with the medal out.
Totally. But I'm thinking perhaps Remembrance Days back in the unit when you all get together to remember your wounded and your fallen and what have you, and your Black Sunday and all that sort of stuff. We all like wearing our medals then and going, yeah, I was there and this was my time and that was your time and everybody's there, and sort of in amongst the tribe, it's okay. Yeah. It's not for anybody else. There will come a day maybe when you're thinking, yeah, I'm really proud of that actually. Do you think?
I am proud of it, and there'll be a day when little Arthur grows up and we talk. But am I going to... that medal has afforded Arthur a different trajectory in life because I now earn a better living. Is that worth...
You set up a business, you set up all other things.
Yeah, is that worth me having a bigger ego for my son to go, this is the medal I won, when I can actually go, I sold the fucking thing and I now earn better money.
It looks like that. And show him the number, show him the equivalent. I totally get that. And for you, as you say, it was financially life-changing. And set you and your partner and Arthur up for what lies ahead. It'll be an interesting thing to see where you, as you say, when Arthur's grown up, where you get to and how you feel about your time. But I'm getting that... Now, you don't come across as bitter and twisted. You come across as pretty level-headed and pretty sorted with it all and quite happy with the role you did, what you did, how it ended up was how it ended up. As you say, shit happens, and a lot of other people came out of these things in a far worse state than you.
Mm.
So you're a success story, for want of a better word, from my point of view, because, you know, interview a lot of guests on this program who are all success stories, but they've taken a long time, but their wounds are, you know, really altered what they can do in life, actually, whereas your injury hasn't. I mean, does it affect you at all? Has somebody told you there's just one exercise you shouldn't be doing? There's one in a contact sports not for you, or, you know, in case this all ruptures?
No, not at all.
There's no impact on your life at all, apart from obviously the mental side.
Not at all. And like I said, this is another reason why I can't look back. I've got no reason to complain. I've got to make the most of it because Head Up started because we all sort of had this quote.
You talked about PTSD resolution helping you out. Talk me about the Heads Up charity.
Heads Up is Prince William's, I believe. We are Head Up. Head Up charity.
Your Head Up?
Yeah. He copied us. So.
Did he?
Yeah, we'll sort it out when I see him.
That charity? What's your involvement?
So I'm a co-founder and I'm currently a trustee. We have Paul Minter, ex-House of Cavalry. He got discharged with PTSD. I say in his case, definitely the army failed him with regards to the treatment, the system and how it worked. He is sort of self-helped a lot, and this is the reason we started Head Up. Our aim is to build a retreat. You initially, as long as you're a serving or ex-serving armed forces veteran, you come to us for 7 days, and it's a positive mindset retreat. We do nighttime routine, you know, how to power down, switch off, sleep properly. We look into quality of sleep. We look into cold water therapy, breath work, your diet. Okay.
This is out camping out in the hills, or
we're going to build a retreat. So we're in the process of finalising where the land is and buying the land at this stage, and then after that we have someone who's going to build the retreat for us. That's all secured. We're just dotting the I's and crossing the T's.
Okay.
Brilliant. So Paul, to raise awareness, ran 5,800 miles around the UK, did 30 miles a day for over 200 days. He stopped at people's houses who were either bereaved families or veterans. The other two trustees have recently just finished the Rowan Atlantic. They finished 10 days ago now.
Okay.
And we have another trustee.
Are you all ex-Household Cavalry?
Three Household Cavalry, apologies, and two rifles. One of them is a guy called Justin Davies, who you may have come across, double amputee, who was the first double amputee to climb Mont Blanc with Harry the Gurkha. Is it Harry Bird? I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Yeah.
So we do have beneficiaries, but all we're doing is like one-day wellness days and signposting them to people. Until that retreat is built, we're not going to be fully operational how we want to be, but we are definitely helping people at the minute, going around to units, giving lectures and giving training days on how to sort of... We're prevention rather than cure, right?
Right.
We don't want you to be kicked out of the army or ringing up PTSD resolution. We want you to manage it, spot the signs, and go back to eating well, getting your sleep, and how to power up, power down, or get yourself out of a hole. That's what we're trying to do. That's the aim.
So ideally targeted to people who are serving.
Serving, yeah. Or I would recommend you do this as part of, not as part of resettlement, because we don't want money for it, but you do that as you're leaving, because I know what I did. I went on the piss and didn't shave for 2 months, and you're not to the best start.
That's... Yeah, you think that that's the dream when you're in.
Yeah, you're not shaving and, you know, you do things that you can't do in the army, and actually you go back to doing exactly what you did in the army. You get up, you wash yourself, you train, you take on food, you drink plenty of water, and you work hard, essentially.
Yeah, and live a better life. Is there any other charity that you've been dealing with or that you work with or that you'd like to highlight at all on your journey or the journey of your... contemporaries, colleagues?
Obviously, the regimental charities are good. It's, you know, there's a personal link there. I know they help people immediately.
But what's your regimental charity? Is there a specific one?
Blues and Rules.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Household Cavalry Foundation and bits and bobs. But for me, if you have PTSD or you feel like you really need to speak to someone, and you're in the army, I will say this as a bloke who got out, I think you need to be careful. I think it can end careers. Because you what happens is you just get sent home, permanent sick leave, and it's over. I would contact PTSD Resolution first. I think they can really help, and they are the most streamlined I've come across.
Okay.
If you're not at that stage, then contact us. We don't have the retreat built yet, but we will signpost you to people that can, you know, and we have relationships with other retreats that we can signpost you to and get you sorted.
Perfect. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it, Simon. Thank you very much for taking us through that hell of a story and for highlighting those charities at the end. I will put their details in the show notes. Presumably you've got a website and a link and stuff. That's really it from me. Have you got anything else you want to add?
Not at all. Thank you for your time. It's always good to meet great blokes from the military. It's good.
It's all part of the therapy I find for me as well as you. Right. That draws a close to this episode. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with my next guest, details of which you will discover if you follow the podcast. Please leave any comments, likes, etc. in the obvious places. And if you are someone who would like to be a guest on this podcast, please get a hold of me at thesearchchicken@gmail.com. And we can take it from there. Thanks.